You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Thousands of diplomats, including 150 world leaders, are meeting in Paris to hammer out an agreement on climate change. President Obama, Xi Jinping, and Narendra Modi are meeting today at the start, perhaps to avert a failure similar to what occurred at Copenhagen in 2009. Pressure for binding commitments on climate change has grown significantly, although past history might lead some to be pessimistic. Bill Nye suggests in his latest book, Unstoppable, Harnessing Science to Change the World, climate change isn't rocket science, it's harder. Still, he's optimistic about our ability to change things for the better with science. His book is published by St. Martin's, and I'm very pleased it has brought Bill Nye back to our show. Hello.
It's so good to be here.
How optimistic are you about the Paris conference?
The Paris conference. I'm somewhat optimistic. The whole thing is, the big news for me today is that 53% of the U.S. populace now accepts that humans are causing global climate change. So that's enough to get elected president, 53%. So if the U.S. is leading the world in addressing climate change, then I think things can happen in Paris.
The president has pledged that the United States will cut its overall emissions by 26% to 28% by 2030. But he faces opposition from Republicans in Congress who say his plan to reduce emissions from U.S. power plants would cost thousands of American jobs and raise electricity costs for businesses and families. And aren't half of the states suing to block the power plant rules?
Well, this is where, as we say, I completely disagree. If we were to exploit the big untapped resource along the East Coast, most of the people in the U.S. live in the Eastern time zone. If we had wind turbines offshore along the eastern seaboard of the U.S., we would have enough energy for everybody many times over. The other thing is we'd create thousands, hundreds of thousands of new jobs. You cannot import every wind turbine and erect it with people from other countries. Those jobs are going to be here in the United States or here in Canada or here in Mexico. Those jobs will be here, and the energy will be free, and people just will stop mining coal the way they do now and go do other industrial-style jobs, and everybody's quality of life will improve, and people sooner or later will figure that out.
Well, you say 53% of the American public believes.
That's as of this morning.
Yeah, well, of course, that means 47% don't, but also a lot of politicians. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wrote an opinion piece for the Washington Post yesterday that accused the president of being so concerned with his legacy that he, quote, prioritizes symbolism over substance. And he wrote that Obama's international negotiating partners in Paris, quote, should proceed with caution before entering into an unattainable deal with this administration because commitments the president makes there would rest on a house of cards of his own making.
Well, in other words, McConnell claims he's going to work very hard to defeat it.
Yes.
That's I understand that. Okay. Knock yourself out, Mitch. But the rest of the world wants to make changes, and now, apparently, Mr. McConnell et al. Are in the minority. So this is, I've heard, thank you, I've heard Mr. Cruz say, well, the trouble is people don't support his point of view. That's democracy. So if more people vote against you than for you, then it's harder to win elections. So this could be a big turning point. I'll tell you anecdotally, I was in Charleston, West Virginia last week, and okay, look, just talk about me. Okay, so several hundred people, 1,000 people showed up.
And several hundred thousand people?
Several hundred, I guess about 1,000 is what I started to say, excuse me, showed up to hear me talk, watch me wave my arms while I talk. And
I hope Donald Trump didn't make fun of you.
Bring it on. So that's what I say to the conservatives. Or not the conservatives, to the climate change deniers. If you can attack me, but the climate's still changing, and that now you have now you're in a minority of people who deny it. So I got standing ovations from the West Virginia audience because I believe, first of all, they're self-selected. I mean, they show up to see me talk and so on. But I think also people in West Virginia are a little worn out from the coal industry. It supports about 30,000 jobs in West Virginia, about the same number in Kentucky. That's a lot of jobs, but it's not that many. With wind energy and solar panels, photovoltaics in those areas, Kentucky and West Virginia, we would have at least 50,000 jobs in each of those, the state and the Commonwealth. We would have 100,000 jobs at least, because this is new technology that has to be built there in situ. Can't put it somewhere else. Now, I know that the coal industry has supported a lot of people for a couple generations, but I'm not sure it's the highest quality job you can have.
Well, you won't get black lung disease.
You don't get black lung harvesting wind energy.
What's unstoppable in your estimation? The name of your book is Unstoppable. Is it the scientific innovation or a changing world?
Well, I want, it's a pun, but I want the next generation of people coming of age right now to be unstoppable. And the people I think about are my grandfather and my father and mother. My grandfather went into World War I on a horse, on a flipping horse. And apparently they ride up pretty close to the front lines, jump off the horses, get in the trenches, and do their warfare thing. My grandfather, you may be shocked to learn, was a chemist and had the responsibility of trying to eliminate dysentery in the canteens, in the trenches. But he did so on a horse. He put a gas mask on himself. He put a gas mask on his horse, for crying out loud. But 20 years later, when my father was taken prisoner of war by the Japanese Navy, nobody who was serious about conducting a war did it on a horse. Everything changed in just 20 years. Everything changed. And so we could do the same. I claim that the next generation can be unstoppable and change our transportation infrastructure completely and change the way we get electricity completely in the next 20 years, certainly in the next 30 years.
You write that the second law of thermodynamics is unstoppable. So
that's one of my favorite quotations from Arthur Eddington.
Well, what's the second law of thermodynamics? And didn't creationists argue that evolution was impossible because it violated the second law of thermodynamics?
So, Leonard, of course, I appreciate it's a radio show, but confusing what drives steam engines with what
drives... Was I just put down?
No.
Okay.
It's what creationists do all the time. Uh-huh. Well, the second law of thermodynamics says that evolution... No, the fundamental thing they miss is that the Earth is not a closed system. There's energy flying in here day and night because the Earth is spinning from the sun. Furthermore, there's primordial heat energy in the center of the Earth. But this fundamental lack of understanding is charming in a way because it's so silly, ludicrous, and so off the point. It's charming. But the limitation, everybody, that's caused by the second law of thermodynamics is that when you have a heat engine, you're burning coal, you're burning gas, you're getting heat out of nuclear fission, there's a limit. You can't get 100% of the energy out. There's a rule, and humans call it the second law of thermodynamics. In other words, in order to get some hot to do some work for you, you have to have some cold. And it's only the difference between hot and cold that allows a heat engine, like a steam engine or the car, the gasoline engine in your car, to work.
My guest is Bill Nye, whose latest book is Unstoppable, Harnessing Science to Change the World. How much of a difference could we as individuals make just by altering what we do day to day?
Well, this is, all politics is local, all energy use is local. The more you do with less energy, the best for everybody. And here in New York, they say cities are built, rebuilt every 30 years. Here in New York, it may be somewhat more slow than that because some of these buildings are so cool, so lovely. But along that line, when we build new buildings, we want them to be as energy efficient as possible. And it is a beautiful thing when you look out at the New York skyline at night and see all these lights. But one cannot help but wonder where all the energy's going to produce all those lights all the time. We couldn't we do a little better in that? And so these are decisions that we can all make. And then the other...
But New York is also a city of renters, or at least a fair number of people. I can't put solar panels on the roof of my house.
But when it's time to vote, you would support electric vehicles, electric taxi cabs, taxi pods, as I envision. These would be self-guided taxis that take up less width on a city street, and they don't crash into each other because they interact electronically. And don't tell me we can't do it. You get on an elevator and you push the button and you trust it's going to go where it's going to go every day, day and night, 365 and a quarter. Then furthermore, the energy that the real unexploited energy resource here on the East Coast, Connecticut, tri-state area, New England, is wind. Wind just offshore. So everybody's probably familiar with the expression the continental shelf. It's the water, the ocean just offshore here is not especially deep. And we have this technology. People drill oil wells on platforms all the time. So we could do it. We could go out there, build wind turbines, set them up, run very large power lines ashore, and use our existing electrical grid to run the world. And then the big thing, everybody, if we were talking about climate change, the way we're talking about the terrorism in Paris, Ferguson, Missouri, the guy who was shot in cold blood by policemen, we would be getting this done. We'd be getting her done.
So you're saying that the biggest hurdles may not be scientific, they may be political?
Absolutely. And then the great thing that we would dream of is policy changes akin to the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, where...
which are under attack politically. Which are,
yeah. Well, but if we've really reached this over 50% of the U.S. voting populace concerned about climate change caused by people, maybe everything's going to change. Maybe we've reached this tipping point that people on my side of this, all imagine happening sooner or later, where everybody realizes this is a very serious problem and we need to take steps to address it. And what we would do is have a policy that you have to pay a fee. Oh, Leonard, we cannot use the T word. Mm-hmm. We cannot say tax. Mm-hmm. We can't say that word. Can't say that word. We'd have a fee on the production of carbon dioxide and the release of methane, fugitive natural gas, as it's called. And that fee then would be used to do what governments do, provide for the common defense, make sure the electrical grid works, have standards for medical safety, and so on. Things that governments do that most people believe in.
Go ahead.
Well, just this fee would lower the cost of everybody's taxes, and it would incentivize or really motivate organizations like corporations that make cars, corporations that make airplanes, corporations that provide electricity to people, would motivate them to do so in a renewable fashion.
My guess is Bill Nye, who's a scientist, engineer, comedian, inventor, as well as the New York Times bestselling author of Undeniable Evolution and the Science of Creation. His latest book is Unstoppable: Harnessing Science to Change the World. It's published by St. Martin's Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Bill Nye, whose latest book is Unstoppable: Harnessing Science to Change the World. It's published by St. Martin's Press. And apropos of what we were discussing, a listener points out that you can get solar energy in New York City by telling Con Ed that you want to use one of the solar producers.
That's right. You can check a box, and Consolidated Edison will get your energy from renewable sources as best as they can.
As a student at Cornell, you studied with astronomer and science popularizer Carl Sagan, and by the way, Neil deGrasse Tyson will be here in our second hour.
He's a good friend of mine,
everybody. Cosmos. For that standpoint, popularizing science, what are the biggest problems in making global warming accessible to the public? Because even 53% is still far from what the scientists are
from
saying.
From 99%, yeah. So how to make it more accessible? This all the publicity the Paris conference is getting is great.
Well, you studied physics and engineering, but so did all four of the Koch brothers.
Yeah. Yeah, so that they're a mystery to me. I have to say, they have kids and grandkids, and they pursue this thing relentlessly. I saw one very reasonable report that they spend $380 million a year supporting candidates who deny climate change. That's if that number is true, it's certainly order of magnitude is correct. It's remarkable.
You've debated climate change deniers. Given the overwhelming scientific consensus, what is behind their remaining skepticism?
Well, there's this old word, denial, and then the Kubler-Ross, when some tragedy happens, a loved one dies, you start out in denial. Then you get angry, then you bargain, then you're depressed, then you accept. Well, they
so
haven't
where
gotten
we now,
past.
Depressed?
Huh?
Where are we now, depressed?
Well, not the deniers are still in denial. Yeah. And I think the reason, like if you have, for example, James Inhofe from Oklahoma.
Who brought a snowball to Congress to prove there wasn't global warming.
Confused snowfall with, I guess the expectation is that there would be no winter at all. Yeah. Not reduced winter or warmer winters, but none at all. Anyway, he literally can't imagine, I think. He grew up in a rural area where his nearest neighbors, kilometers or miles away, and he couldn't imagine that a human populace could change the climate of an entire planet, just beyond what he can conceive. And so he's wrong and so on, and he's in charge. But sooner or later, those people will age out. Climate change denial is almost entirely a generational thing. There once in a while you'll meet a young person in climate change denial, but almost everybody who's in denial is older.
For years, journalists treated deniers like Bjorn Lomborg as serious challengers to climate science. How did the media treatment affect the political or the scientific debate?
Well, this whole thing of giving equal time to both sides seems like a good idea. It seems reasonable, especially if you use the word debate to discuss things. But in the case of climate change, the scientific consensus is overwhelming. 97%, certainly, but maybe more like 99% of the world scientists are concerned about climate change, but accept that humans are causing it, and so on. But this journalistic tradition of giving both sides the same amount of time has led to a little bit of trouble. But we are overcoming that.
Have you created any enemies by taking these positions?
Well,
I know
sure.
you stoked controversy in a video where you said that denial of evolution is unique to the United States.
Well, once in a while you meet people in Britain who have an issue, but very seldom. I mean, nowhere else, especially in a technically sophisticated society like New Zealand or Japan or some exotic place like Egypt, you don't meet people who don't believe in evolution.
In that video, you said, if you try to ignore that, meaning evolution, your worldview becomes crazy, and you urge adults who don't believe in evolution, don't make your kids do it.
That's my big concern, is the future. That if you have a grown-up who's denies evolution because of his or her upbringing, it's very difficult to change that person's mind. And this is a perfect analog to climate change. It's very difficult to change that person's mind. But you don't want kids growing up scientifically illiterate because we need them to innovate. What keeps the U.S. in the game economically is our ability to innovate. And that comes from science, and that comes from kids who get excited about science in general before they're 10 years old. With that said, Leonard, is something going to happen after the holidays when people get through the stress of buying gifts and running around the country and so on? Is somebody who's running for president on the conservative side going to have an epiphany? Like, I've been thinking about climate change, and boy, this is a serious problem. And the reason he or she would do this is to get the votes of millennials, Is that going to happen? I'm not an expert on these sort of things. Is that even possible? Or are these people so entrenched that, and they've done the calculus so carefully that they don't need any votes from young people? Is that possible? Is that true? You don't need any young person's votes to get elected?
You probably got a lot of people upset after you gave a backstage interview for Real Time with Bill Maher last February when you said that you were revising your stance and revising your book chapter on GMOs.
I did. There's the paperback version of Undeniable is available in bookstores. There's 20 in a carton. They make great gifts for the holidays. So what I did, I based that chapter originally on research I had done 10 years ago. And I'm on the advisory board of the Union of Concerned Scientists, and I spent a lot of time with these people. And I was concerned that you couldn't know, you could know very well, extremely well, the genome of the plant that you genetically modify, but you couldn't be certain of what would happen to the ecosystem. And in the last, well, even 6 years, our ability to sequence or assay the gene sequence of a plant has increased about 10 million fold, about 10 to the 7th times we can do it about 10 to the 7th times faster than we used to be able to. With that said, I am satisfied now that you can really predict how a corn plant will interact with its ecosystem because every gene is so well known.
But in the past, when you put a corn plant next to a different species of corn plant and wound up with a hybrid, you were just dealing with corn. But with GMOs, you're putting a fish gene into the corn. And
well, not in the corn, but in tomatoes. Yeah, but
or whatever.
I know what you're saying.
And now we have salmon with eel genes in them. So
that's a good
example.
I was just going to talk about salmon. So in the case of corn, in the case of soybeans, it's been shown now, the big example was sweet potatoes earlier this year, that genes do move between species naturally, generally carried by the biological equivalent of a virus, a gene that can carry a gene, or a group of genes, rather, that can carry a gene between plant species. Apparently it's pretty common in nature.
Bees take them from one plant to the other.
And by the way, the problem with the colony collapse disorder in bees, I'm just a small digression, seems to be the biggest problem is lack of diversity in the bee population. In other words, we have bred bees so in such a narrow genealogical slit or window that they're not resistant to diseases that there used to be naturally occurring resistance to. So that seems like a solvable problem also. But in the case of salmon, here's one that I worry about. This is after the book was written, after the book was revised, where people are breeding salmon to grow much faster than natural salmon by introducing genes from other aquatic species. And many steps have been taken to ensure that these fish are safe to eat. But I have spent time in Canada. I've spent time in the Pacific Northwest. And I've seen how people behave when nobody's looking. And I've seen how people behave, especially with respect to catching fish. I'm just concerned that some of these fish could end up in the natural ecosystem, outcompete the ancient species, and mess up the ecosystem because they'd be eating the food sources faster than they used to be eaten. So this is one where I stroke my chin. But when it comes to corn and soybeans and cucumbers and watermelons and the stuff that seed manufacturers or seed producers, rather, are creating, I'm not that worried about that.
And Monsanto changed your mind?
Well, Monsanto and Dow, Pioneer Seeds. And the other thing that really impressed me, I went to the Monarch Venture. So this is the hippies who follow monarch butterflies around, and the corporate pigs whose products are killing the milk flower, the milkweed, that prevents the monarch butterflies from having enough to eat. And they got together and decided, well, this is a serious problem. And they've created these refuges, largely voluntarily, of milk, well, I like to call them milk flowers, milkweed, So the now, this year, the monarch butterfly population has gone up. Strangely enough, the corporate pigs and the hippies work together to solve this one high-profile problem.
My guest is Bill Nye. His latest book, Unstoppable, edited by Corey S. Powell.
Corey's a good guy. He's a good guy.
It's published by St. Martin's Press, and this is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Are you concerned at all that fewer people are taking science courses in college? Hasn't finance become the most popular major in recent years?
It could be. What fun is that? So what we say in my business, National Science Teachers Association and Council for Science International, is we talk about the importance of science every day in every grade. Every day in every grade. I'm talking about preschool, kindergarten, all the way up through high school. Take a little bit of science, a little bit of time every day for science. And the reason you want to do this, you hate me, you hate everything, you're a miserable person. The reason you want to do this is to keep the United States competitive economically. So everything was going great on Common Core, read and write and arithmetic for every student. Everything was going very well there until the educators were consulted and said, we need to include science, which would include evolution every day in science class. And then certain people who were very supportive of it decided it was big government intruding on their way of life and so on. So this is a solvable problem also. Very concerned about science education in this country, yes.
You describe your own fascination with the submarine Nautilus when you were a kid.
Oh, man, that was wild.
You built a model of the Nautilus, and you write the packaging for that in the 1950s, hailed the sub as atom-powered, and the model is all plastic. Things have changed.
Well, the model was plastic, yeah.
But, I mean, they were proud of that. Like, wow, isn't this great? All plastic.
Oh, yes.
And atom-powered. Nowadays, both of those things might be seen as problematic.
Well, plastic
in moderation. Post-Chernobyl, anyway.
Yeah, plastic in moderation. I mean, plastic is The Graduate, the movie where he whispers, you know, the future is plastics. Look around you, everybody. There's plastic everywhere. It's a great thing. It's just you don't want to throw it in the ocean. It's a valuable resource.
Well, I saw The Graduate. I'm fully aware of that. Yeah. Is there a technology nowadays that's as fascinating as nuclear power might have been 60 years ago?
Well, for me, it's the opportunities are in batteries. If you can invent a better battery or better family of batteries that stores more energy, weighs less, uses less or fewer exotic materials, and lasts, can take many, many deep cycles, you will change the world. And, of course, as I like to point out, you could also get rich.
And Tesla and some other companies have been working on that.
Oh, yeah.
Why is it so difficult?
Oh, it's I can't change the laws of physics, Leonard. But it's a difficult chemical problem to make batteries that perform as well as a gas tank. You know, I've driven electric cars for years. I had the EV1. I had the Mini Cooper Electric. I had the Nissan Leaf. I've driven a Tesla just the other day on camera. And the batteries have come a long, long way in just 10 years. You compare how far batteries have come, let's say 12 years, how far batteries have come in the last 15 years to how far car engines have come in the last century and a half. I mean, if you screw around with something for 150 years, I hope you can improve it a little bit. We've been messing around with automotive vehicular batteries for maybe 20 years. There's many, many improvements yet ahead.
I mentioned nuclear power. Do we need to consider nuclear to meet the global energy demand?
Well, I'm open-minded. I do my best to be open-minded. Nuclear energy held great promise when I was a kid. Too cheap to meter. But what's happened, there are about 432 commercial nuclear power plants in the world today.
Some countries are closing them down, Italy, Germany.
Yeah, well, the trouble is nobody wants them. Now, in France, they have dozens of them, and the people who run them are very well respected, and they've had hardly any problem at all with them. However, they're reaching that age. They're 40 years old. This is the time when big industrial systems with valves and steam running everywhere and plumbing that gets very hot. It's the time when things start to have problems. So we'll see what happens. And still, there is nobody really has the final solution to storing nuclear waste. And this makes populations anxious. Then this very recent study done at Stanford over the last 10 years called the Solutions Project. These guys and gals believe that you don't need nuclear power to satisfy all of our energy needs if you embrace wind, solar, tidal, geothermal energy in the appropriate fashion in all the geographic locations in the U.S. Well, with that said, I'm very interested in this next generation of nuclear reactor that would shut itself down, that whose waste would be manageable. It would be cooled with, no kidding, carbon dioxide gas.
Where do you put the waste? Isn't that
big problem? Well, there's so little waste that you could bury it in ancient places that are generally inaccessible to the public. However, what would happen in 200 years and so on? But this idea that nuclear power is the panacea, that if these kooks would just get out of the way, we'd solve this problem. I'm skeptical of that because the nuclear industry has not proven itself to be especially good. And this is my claim. Chernobyl was a disaster because the engineers did this and that. And then people say, well, they shouldn't have been doing that. Well, they did.
And then Fukushima.
Well, they shouldn't have built it there. They did. And then Three Mile Island, I don't know if people live around here remember this. Nothing happened, but it almost did. And so if you have 430 or 433 power plants that have had three just really significant problems, what's going to happen when there are 14,000 of these things? Sure. There's going to be trouble. Are people willing to accept that? For me, I would rather just hustle on wind turbines and photovoltaics and so-called concentrated solar, where you have mirrors and you get something hot and use that energy to run a turbine.
We're pretty much out of time, but I want to address one other issue. Maybe
Thank
we can
you.
Go through it quickly. We're changing our environment by other means, like with chemicals like pesticides and plastics. Do we need to be addressing that as well?
Yes, and this is Uncle Bill's thing. Do everything all at once. There is no panacea. There's no one thing that's going to solve the problem. And this is where people get in this thing, well, I have learned to meditate and I can concentrate on a candle flame. It took me 10 years. Okay, fine for you. We've got to do everything all at once. While you're doing this, do that. And I'm not talking about juggling. I'm talking about everybody working together to this common goal to do more with less. And ultimately, to be unstoppable in changing the world. Come on, everybody.
Bill Nye, Unstoppable, Harnessing Science to Change the World. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.